Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're ready to hear argument in the case of Lewis against Chicago. Ms. Solon.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please report? The district court's judgment for plaintiffs rests on its finding that the city's decision to set the cutoff score for the 1995 firefighters test at 89 points had a severe disparate impact on African-American applicants. And in awarding relief, the district court made a further finding that but for the hiring practices found to be discriminatory, 132 additional African Americans would have been hired. By the time the case reached the Supreme Court, the plaintiffs advanced a different theory, and the court held that each use of the list could be charged as an unlawful employment practice. The court did not decide whether plaintiffs proved that claim, merely that it was cognizable. And the court did not reject our argument that plaintiffs did not prove this claim, but remanded for this court to determine the issue if it was preserved. This afternoon, I will explain that plaintiffs failed to prove the present violation they alleged, and that we have preserved both reversal on that ground and, in the alternative, modification of the judgment to omit relief for the first use of the list, which plaintiffs concede is excessive.
So your argument is that that 89 cutoff had no effect?
Our argument is that any disparate impact traceable...
Answer my question.
It had an effect on the composition of the hiring eligibility list and, in particular, the well-qualified pool. That effect is time-barred. It can no longer be charged. We are entitled to treat it as lawful under the law of the case.
But every time they used that cutoff when they were hiring new firemen. Are you saying that had no effect on the racial composition of the
department? It had no effect on the racial composition of who was hired for this reason. The application of that cutoff score to the results and then the making the list and limiting hiring in the first initial rounds to the well-qualified pool eliminated the plaintiffs from further consideration for the first 10.5 rounds of hiring. When the city proceeded in those 10.5 rounds of hiring to call from the list that it had made outside the charging period, which we are entitled to treat as lawful, the court tells us, it had no effect on the plaintiffs. And they did not prove that it had any effect on them. Their proof at trial centered on the exam and the cutoff score. They did not direct any proof to use of the list, except perhaps in the colloquial sense, where use of the list manifested the same results that had already occurred. But the exclusion of the plaintiffs occurred when that list was made. The African Americans were 45% of the class of the pool of test takers. They were 11.5% of the well-qualified pool, and that is precisely the basis on which the district court found disparate impact, and it is the only basis on which the district court found disparate impact. Now, all of that was outside the charging period, and the court...
Counsel, I understand that, but fundamentally, the Supreme Court said that disparate impact could be shown, and indeed must be shown, hiring class by hiring class. And your argument now sounds like an argument that disparate impact hasn't been shown on that theory. And that may be right, but you never appealed from the judgment on the merits. Your only appeal concerned whether the charge was timely. How can we get to the question whether disparate impact has been shown class by class given the lack of appeal on the merits?
With respect, Your Honor, our first notice of appeal, our only notice of appeal, was from the district court's judgment. We appealed from the final judgment, and it brought up the entire case.
But your brief addressed only the limitations question.
Our opening brief was directed to the district court's judgment. It was precisely the theory that we lost on. As I explained, the district court made only one finding of disparate impact. And it was traced to...
Right. And I could imagine, therefore, that you would argue on appeal that this difference, that the question about where the cutoff point is set doesn't establish that any given hiring class has either a disparate impact or that there's lack of business necessity. But no argument remotely like that was in your opening brief.
We have no quarrel with that reading of our opening brief, Your Honor. Our position on both our litigation in the district court and our opening brief in the prior appeal is that we did everything we needed to do once the district court denied our motion for summary judgment and determined that the theory of the case would be continuing violation. This court has never required an appellant to continue to resist definitive rulings of the district court, and we cite those cases in our brief. And so as far as, you know, the stipulation.
You don't have to argue with the district judge, but after you lose a case, you have to make all your arguments in the Court of Appeals.
We made arguments against every ground on which we lost. The district court found a continuing violation. That was the only theory of liability. And because of that theory of liability, the district court proceeded to find that 132 additional African Americans would have been hired. That's on A32 and 33 of our opening brief appendix. That's the only finding of disparate impact that was made, and it was made solely because we continued to use the list, which had disparate impact, but of course was outside the charging period. Plaintiffs responded, and again, we do cite in our briefs the cases that make clear that while an appellant is required to put all arguments for reversal in its opening brief, it need not put any argument on alternative theories in the opening brief. And so, as I say, I will put to the side our handling of the case in the district court and the opening brief in the prior appeal. When the plaintiffs...
Let me ask a very simple question. Suppose that in 1980 the fire department said, we're not going to hire any black people. And then in 2000, a black person applies and he's turned down. Now, can't he challenge that exclusionary decision even though it was made many years earlier?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. There's a 300-day charging period, and the charging period is regarded as jurisdictional.
No, but the 300 days, I thought, on the Supreme Court's decision, would run from the time at which he's turned down,
yeah.
Not from the original.
I'm sorry. Perhaps I misunderstood.
Yeah.
I might
he
have
applies misunderstood. In 2000. He's turned down within 300 days. He files his... charged with the EOC, so can he do that?
Yes.
And what's the difference between that and this case?
The case Your Honor is describing, I think, looks a lot like Griggs or a lot
what
like
Gratz.
What
it looks like, look,
it, the reason
there's
those
liability there, why isn't there liability here?
Because the only act that the district court found had disparate impact occurred outside the charging period. And we know for two reasons.
But
that
so
that
you're saying that the cutoff, the 89 cutoff that was applied repeatedly had no racial effect?
It was not. Plaintiffs did not prove at trial that calling
are you
from...
Are you saying it had no racial effect?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. Not
well,
once
how could
the,
it not? I mean, what are the facts that would allow one to conclude it had no effect?
Once the well-qualified pool was made and the decision was made to limit hiring to that pool, all of which, as I say, occurred outside the charging period, simply plaintiffs were rejected at that time, and that's the difference between this case and the hypothetical that Your Honor poses. When plaintiffs got the letter, they were told, you will not be hired for indefinitely, if at all. That was a rejection. They're not in doubt. They were not in doubt whether that was clear enough. They don't argue that any longer. And the Supreme Court tells us that all of that is lawful because it's outside the charging period. The only thing the city did within the charging period was a separate practice. And the court is very clear for two reasons. We say that
what
disparate
was
impact
separate practice?
Hiring from the list was a separate practice from compiling the list. And we know that for two reasons. The first reason is that it's law of the case.
Why is that any different from my example? Where turning down someone is different from having announced many years earlier a policy against hiring these people.
I think I must have misunderstood your hypothetical. If a policy that is facially discriminatory, the court... I'm sorry,
really
I missed it too.
Look, all I said was suppose in 1980 the fire department announced we won't hire black people, okay. And in 2000 some black person applies and they turn him down if they have this policy, and right. He files a charge.
That charge is timely under Bazemore.
So what's the difference between that case and this case?
Because that policy in that case is facially discriminatory, right on its face, and the court tells us there's a different rule for those cases. That's the Bazemore case. In this case, there is no such policy. Our policy was to hire from the well-qualified list. That is a facially neutral policy.
Why does that make a difference, whether it's neutral on its face or inconsequent? Or neutral on its face but has bad consequences?
It makes a difference because every Title VII plaintiff must show a present violation within the charging period. That means evidence of each element of their claim. The claim here was disparate impact, and plaintiffs did not show disparate impact within the charging period. Once they were excluded from the well-qualified list, there was no disparate impact on anybody.
I don't see how you can say that. Plaintiffs allege that there was disparate impact in a particular way, that is, the establishment of the 89 cutoff, right? The district court found that there was disparate impact. As I understand it, the city didn't even deny that there was disparate impact. Now, what should have happened, we now know from the Supreme Court's opinion, was the plaintiffs had a bad theory. The city should have said, that's a bad theory. The right theory is to ask about each class, each hiring class, class by class. And when the district court didn't accept the city's argument, the city should have appealed. But none of those things happened. The question I've been asking is, how can we get to any of that now, given that they never happened in this case?
Okay, let me try to take those in order. In the hypothetical that you propose, I'm sorry, as you described the Supreme Court's decision, it is that the hiring criteria, the list was established outside the charging period. Now, we know for two reasons. Both the statute itself, section K1B little I, requires the plaintiff to show specific disparate impact chargeables to each specific practice that is challenged. Now, we know that making the list is different from hiring from the list because the Supreme Court treats them differently. The Supreme Court answers that question for us. The court tells us that they are different because even though a claim against use of the list is time-barred, and indeed the list must be regarded as lawful, plaintiffs nonetheless have a cognizable claim against use of the list. That means that use and adoption of the list and use of the list can be separated. Now, section K1...
But it also means, Ms. Solomon, that in the Supreme Court's view, it is possible to have the disparate impact established from the use of the list.
It is possible.
In your view, it is not possible because the creation of the list would always be treated as lawful, and therefore the use of the list would have to be lawful.
It is possible.
That can't be the Supreme Court's view.
Your Honor, the Supreme Court held that the plaintiffs had a cognizable claim, and we understand that they had a cognizable claim. A cognizable claim means a claim that they have to prove. And our submission is...
What do you think they'd have to prove?
To be honest, Your Honor, once they fail to challenge the adoption of the list and the list is used only in random selection, we don't think they can prove a claim. Correct. Within the well-qualified pool, the city called only randomly within that pool. Plaintiffs actually admit that using the well-qualified list didn't injure them. It's on page 51 of their brief. They admit they would have no standing to challenge the use of the calling from within the well-qualified pool. And that's because it didn't injure them. The injury was outside the charging period, and we are entitled to treat it as lawful. All the Supreme Court said on this question was, go back to the Court of Appeals. We are not going to examine the merits.
What
the
page court of did you say?
51, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals should examine the merits, and that is what we are doing here today. Our submission is that both the statute, Section K1B little I, and the law of the case require that this court analyze adoption of the list and calling from the list as separate employment practices.
On page 51 and elsewhere was that if you could prove that the use of the bad list had no consequences, then of course there'd be no discrimination.
Well, they're the plaintiff, right. Of course, so they had to prove that it did. We don't have to prove that it didn't. We also didn't have to tell them that they had a bad theory.
But given the 89 cutoff, didn't that exclude people?
It did exclude people, and it was also outside the charging period. Now, I just want to go back.
Outside the charging period. In my example of a 1980 exclusionary decision, that's outside the charging period. But you say that's fine, there can still be liability for a refusal to hire 20 years later if it's based on that.
Is it somehow because that's, as
you say, facial discrimination rather than...
Yes, the court tells us in this case that everything outside the charging period...
Where is that distinction in the Supreme Court's opinion?
The court cites Evans, it's page A8 and 9, and says we are entitled to treat adopting the list as lawful. If I can just go back very quickly to Judge Easterbrook's question on
adopting the list. Well, it happened too long ago, but...
Correct.
But the use of the list...
The use of the list was
why
in
didn't
the
Supreme Court just... Why didn't it throw out the case on your theory?
It decided only whether it was a cognizable claim and remanded on the merits.
But in their decision... Their decision requires dismissal of the suit.
It requires this court to answer whether the plaintiffs proved their claim or not, and we submit that they did not. Very briefly, just to go back to Chief Judge Easterbrook's question on our handling of the prior appeal, I urge the court to review our prior reply brief on pages 3-9. I think the court will see that we have been making the same argument all along. Nothing happened within the charging period, and that is why they failed to prove their claim. Indeed, this is the theory that this panel adopted in the first appeal. This court was not reversed on that ground. It was reversed simply on whether that concept was properly considered in terms of the charging period. And the court said no. It doesn't have anything to do with whether it's a cognizable claim. Go back and look at it on the merits. I'd like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Ms. Solomon. Mr. Strauss.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The issue before us is whether the city preserved an argument about proof of disparate impact, and the simple answer to that is that the city did not. In the district court, the city...
It's hard to see how the city preserves an argument when you never made the kind of argument that the Supreme Court said would be a good one. That's the puzzle here, that the plaintiffs make a line of argument about 89 being a bad cutoff, which doesn't prevail in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says you have to analyze hiring class by hiring class. That argument was never advanced in the district court. The city never replied to it, obviously. And it seems a little odd now to say, well, the city didn't respond to the argument that we never made, and we never made it because it wasn't created until the Supreme Court decided this case last year.
I think there's three things to say about that. The first thing is that the city said that proof of disparate impact or any type of disparate impact was not an issue in the case. Not only did the city stipulate that there was disparate impact, including the city stipulated in the that there was disparate impact.
The city says they stipulated that there was disparate impact on the plaintiff's theory, which is that we analyze the whole list at one go. right? But the Supreme Court said the right question is not the whole list at one go, but whether there was disparate impact each time the list was used. In other words, hiring class by hiring class.
But
did the city ever stipulate that there was disparate impact on that theory?
Yes, in two ways, Your Honor. The first and most important way is what the parties said was the issue in the pretrial order. The pretrial order determined what the parties were going to try, and the city did not raise any issue about the plaintiff's prima facie case whatsoever in the pretrial order. It was granted that the prima facie case was proved in its entirety. That wasn't an issue. The only issue that the city said was for the trial was its defenses.
When you said proved, did you mean proved or admitted?
I'd mean admitted, Your Honor. Thank you.
I would hope.
Yeah. The only issue that was for trial was the question of the city's defenses and whether this test and this score was job-related. The second way that the city, if I can get the citation just for a minute, in after the liability trial, we submitted proposed findings of fact that said that the city's practice from 1996 through 2002 had a severe and disparate impact on African Americans. And the city responded to that, adverse, quote, adverse impact has never been disputed in this case, and it was not an issue at trial.
So your argument, let me see if I understand it. You're saying it's true the only argument we articulated, that is the 89 cutoff, proves to be a bad argument as the Supreme Court understood this. But we never had a reason to articulate a better argument because the city was never denying our claim.
I'm not following. In two ways, Your Honor. We did articulate and argue in the district court both statute of limitations arguments. We did.
No, I'm not worried about the statute of limitations argument. Yeah. Was there ever any time in the district court, or for that matter in this court on the first appeal, when you said the right thing to do is to ask whether any particular use of the list is discriminatory? So suppose in wave of hiring two, the city is hiring only people who got 98 on the test, right? Long way away from 89. The city is hiring the 98s this year. We're now going to show that hiring the 98s created a disparate impact because predominantly whites and not blacks who got 98, and we're now going to focus on the question whether hiring 98s but not, say, 88s was justified by business necessity.
The
question ever even come up in the district court?
Yes, it came up in the remedy phase. In the remedy phase of the trial, the parties agreed that there was a shortfall with respect to each class in terms of hiring, and that that was an agreement by the experts on each side, and there was a finding by the district court of a shortfall class by class. And that was a finding that there was a disproportionate effect of the city's rule of not hiring anyone who had a score of 89 or less. Now, the city, on this appeal, doesn't dispute that that's evidence of disparate impact, at least not in looking at its briefs. In particular, if you look at their reply brief, Your Honor, if you look at their reply brief on page 5, footnote 4, they're talking about the shortfall evidence. And they say about the shortfall evidence, to be clear, the shortfall is not insufficient because it was determined in the liability phase. It's insufficient because it doesn't show disparate impact caused by a practice analytically distinct from decisions made outside the charging period. That is, the city is repeating the argument that it made about the statute of limitations, but it's not disputing that the shortfall evidence established disparate impact.
Now, one final question. Did the city ever argue in the district court, either at the liability phase or the remedy phase, that the hiring of a particular class was job-related, justified by business necessity, even though other things might not be? That is, did it ever say, look, we're hiring the 98s in this particular hiring class. Hiring the 98s rather than the 88s is justified, even though hiring the 90s rather than the 88s would not be justified.
No, I don't believe it ever made that argument. And no, the answer to that is no, it never made that argument. I want to be as clear as I can be, first of all, that the waiver of the city is, as Judge Easterbrook suggests, shown most clearly by the city's failure to make any argument about disparate impact on appeal. The argument that the opposing party didn't prove its case, didn't offer evidence of a prima facie case, is a classic argument that you would make on appeal. If you're going to say that the other side didn't prove its case, you have to say that on appeal in your opening brief, or you've waived the argument. And that's what the city did. The city chose to make an argument about statute of limitations. It could have argued in the alternative that plaintiffs hadn't proven their case, hadn't put in the evidence, but they failed to make that argument entirely. And their decision not to make that argument was just a completely consistent with what they did in the district court, which was to argue solely on the basis of the limitations grounds and to stipulate with respect to disparate impact. They never thought this was an issue, and the reason they didn't think it was an issue is the numbers weren't there. They're simply, the numbers were clear that there was a disparate impact. Yes, Your Honor.
It may well be that the numbers were clear that there was a disparate impact, even if we go hiring class by hiring class. But, of course, the reason I asked my last question is, it's much easier to have a business necessity defense if you're saying, here's why we hired the 98s rather than hiring everybody who passed at random. Much easier to make that business necessity defense than it is to make a defense of here's why we hired the 90s rather than the 88s.
I think it would be, but I think that...
But you say it was never made. It
certainly was never made, and I don't think that's how the city did its hiring. I think once... In any case, the answer is the city could have made that argument, never did make that argument.
Doesn't the city go in order on the list?
I don't believe so. I don't know the answer to that. I thought that they simply took the people in the group that they said was highly qualified and then chose among those at random. But I'm not. I don't know the answer to that.
I think she says. Salomon said that, didn't she?
I'm not sure.
A few minutes ago?
No. I'm not sure. The city's stipulations were complete and without qualification. And having made those stipulations, the plaintiffs were entitled to rely on them. There's really no reason to ask why the plaintiffs didn't put more evidence into the record. If your opposing party says this matter is proven, then there's no reason why you would, in the district court, put in any more evidence about it.
Not proven.
If the opposing party concedes the issue, there's no reason to put in any evidence about it. Indeed, where the city has stipulated to disparate impact and hasn't even listed disparate impact as an issue for trial, if the plaintiffs had started to put in evidence to prove disparate impact, the district court judge would certainly have been within her rights to ask, what are you doing? Why are you wasting my time? This issue has been foreclosed. It's already been agreed to and stipulated to. With respect to the pretrial order, it's worth looking at exactly what the city said were the issues in the pretrial order. It said, first, the issue is whether first processing the well-qualified applicant pool was job-related and consistent with business necessity. Then it said an issue was whether the plaintiffs have proven that there was an alternative that was equally valid and had less adverse impact. And then it said there was an issue as to whether the African American Firefighters League had standing. But there was absolutely no argument whatsoever about the disparate impact or whether the plaintiffs had adequately proved disparate impact. I don't think there's anything else I need to argue unless the court has any other questions.
Look like it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strauss. Ms. Solomon.
Just two quick points, Your Honor. Beginning first with the merits, I listened very carefully for counsel to identify any disparate impact that the plaintiffs proved at trial from the city's use of the well-qualified pool that creation of the well-qualified pool did not already have, and he did not identify any. And it must be additional and attributable solely to use of the list for two reasons. The first is law of the case. That's the present violation.
I don't understand solely.
Because the prior
practice... In any case where you're using some disparate impact policy, the policy is obviously going to be a causal factor.
Correct. But section K1Bi tells us what cause means in dealing with disparate impact practices. It tells us, and I quote, with respect to demonstrating that a particular employment practice causes disparate impact as described in subparagraph A1, the complaining party shall demonstrate that each practice causes the impact. Now, the court tells us, it's the law of the case, Your Honor, that everything outside the charging period is lawful, and that's why it has to be attributable to an act in the charging period. Now, counsel mentions the shortfall evidence. That did not measure the disparate impact from use of the list. It measured disparate impact from making the list, the difference between the pool of test takers and the well-qualified pool. That disparate impact was not caused by use of the list. It was caused when the list was adopted.
What then was the purpose of the Supreme Court's decision?
The Supreme Court remanded to this court for purposes of determining whether
plaintiffs... Talking about the remand, but the way you describe it, the result ordained by the Supreme Court is no different from, you know, the ordinary statute of limitations running from the adoption of the practice with, you know, maybe defense of equitable estoppel or equitable tolling.
If I understand,
what would be an example of a case in which there would be liability?
A
case like this where there's an initial policy that has a disparate impact and it's used many years later to deny equal treatment. And, of course, the Supreme Court stresses the word use a great deal. So what would be an example where there would be liability?
Well, I have two responses, Your Honor, very quickly, because I know I'm over my time.
I'm asking for an example.
An example where use of the list would, where plaintiffs could prove, some other plaintiff could prove, use of a list had disparate impact, would be a rank order list, which counsel is correct. This was not a rank order list. This list was used after it was made for random selection within the well-qualified pool. Now, a rank order list, if used in the following fashion, there could be a claim when the list is used. Suppose there are 20 people who take a test, and they are ranked 10 white at the top, and then the next 10 are minority. Until the employer says how it will use the list, how many hires it will make, there is no way of knowing whether there's disparate impact or not from use of the list. If the employer hires all 20, of course, there isn't. And so that's a situation where it won't be known until the list is used. Now, we don't have that case here, but that doesn't mean that the remand was pointless. What it means is that the Supreme Court was not willing to do that itself. It regarded the issue as not before it, and that's very common when an appellate court has not passed on an issue of proof.
Do you want a retrial at which they would try?
No, just a remand, Your Honor. It doesn't go beyond this court.
No, do you want a retrial?
No, we don't. We don't.
Both parties. You don't want to give them a chance to fit their case to the Supreme Court's new rule?
No, Your Honor, and they don't even ask for it. And I think the reason they don't is because they know they can't prove it. Not when the wealth creating the list is outside the charging period and thereafter is used only for random selection. That case cannot be proved, and that's why they don't ask for a remand. That's why they have only one argument in this court, and it's the shortfall evidence, and that is insufficient. We would ask the court to reverse the judgment and in the alternative to remand for modification of the judgment to exclude the first use. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.